Hello and welcome to this episode of The Politics of Living. I'm your host, Denise Kovalchuk. This program takes a look at the politics and all that we experience in life, whether it's talking about feminism in the music industry or the power of music as meditation, to women becoming visible in spite of society to try to keep them invisible. Politics are everywhere. On today's show, new contributor Kali Giaridi explores some of the challenges and shares a few success stories from the disability community. Kristen Thiel introduces us to two women considered invisible by their countries, but each making themselves hard to ignore. Darka Dusty returns with 10 Minutes with Darka. She chats with Dandy Warhol band member Zia McCabe, and Deborah Giannini shares some thoughts and a song. But first, Anessa Anderson chats with Canadian singer-songwriter Jennifer Berezin. Jennifer is intent on blurring the artistic boundaries and, most importantly, the distinction between musical styles, politics, spiritual life, environmental activism, and whatever else might come her way.
You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and so I think I was really influenced just by the political and musical environment that I was raised in, so that in those times, it always felt like music was bigger than just, you know, the song itself. So much of what I was influenced by and loved growing up was music that expressed something about the kind of desires of the time, which was for, you know, a certain kind of liberation and peace and justice. And I was very influenced by that, as well as growing up in a pretty progressive Catholic setting. You know, there was a whole social justice aspect, 60s and 70s, a lot of stuff around activism and justice, especially in Latin America and, you know, around the world. So I got influenced by teachers who were involved in that. You know, like when I went to church as a kid, we had Bob Dylan songs playing in the services. So, you know, it was influenced by those movements, I guess you could call them. So I always felt like music was partly beyond it being an art in itself, but an expression of something larger. So for me, that initially included a lot of being asked when I was just in college to sing at all kinds of rallies and conferences and marches and things like that. But I also developed a kind of a side in my work that was more spiritual. I got really influenced by world music and emerging kind of earth-based spiritualities, and saw how much art and music and ritual were part of those traditions and how needed they are in our time.
You know, sometimes people say, oh, nobody's making protest music anymore, and I know exactly what you're talking about to that time. The Dylans, the Joan Baez voices that were out there speaking to injustice. I see rap music, hip-hop, as being kind of the leaders right now. What do you see out there from the younger generation?
I think it depends on where you're looking. You know, I mean, I don't think you're going to hear it much on the radio, but I think in any community, you'll find kind of homegrown grassroots music with lots of young people creating music with messages. You know, they may not be getting, they may not be on TV or on, on the radio. I mean, the 60s was kind of an anomaly in that sense, I think. But it's out there for sure. You can find it in every community here in Berkeley. If you go to our local music club, The Freight and Salvage, it's a very renowned place nationally. All kinds of artists with great messages play there pretty much every night of the week. You can go see somebody, and there are a lot of people writing conscious music, for sure.
You're not your typical singer-songwriter. You know, you're really pushing your boundaries, and you know how your bio says that you blur the distinctions between styles, politics, and spirituality. But what most caught my attention was that your CDs have featured guest appearances by the amazing Bruce Cockburn, whose most recent album I just love so much, and Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls, the actress Olympia Dukakis, which is like, I'd love to hear what she had to contribute. But my eye really fell to Jack Kornfield. How did you interpolate Jack Kornfield into your work?
Many years ago, in my 20s, I went on my first meditation retreat, and I discovered mindfulness practice, and it's been a big part of my life for decades. I use music a lot I collaborate with meditation teachers, Dharma teachers, and one of the people that I know through that community is Jack. He founded Spirit Rock Meditation Center that's here in the Bay Area, and I work there. I bring my music there for retreats and events and Earth Day and all kinds of things. And so, you know, we've been connected for many, many years. And through that community, I asked him if he would be on one of my albums, if he would grace it with reading a piece from the Metta Sutta that's a loving kindness meditation. And he said yes so graciously. And so he's on the recording, and he's part of the live performances that we do of that piece. So it's been a great gift to know him. And I'm like you, I've been really influenced by his work, because people may not know, but he's one of the main Westerners who brought Buddhist practice, mindfulness practice to the West early on in the 60s, early 70s.
The concept of your music, it reminds me of the devotional work of, say, Krishna Das, if you're familiar with him.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Pakistani Qawwali singers, the Sufi devotional music like the now no longer with us Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. Tell me how that came to be born in your life. I mean, you could have just been a strummer on a guitar. What is your instrument, by the way?
I'm a guitarist, yeah. I'm a very devoted guitarist. And actually, Bruce Coburn has been one of my musical heroes since I was, you know, about 18 years old, 17. Seen him many, many, many times. He's probably my favorite songwriter, maybe. Well, maybe not. Joni Mitchell.
Oh, no. I'm right there with you. That most recent album of his, I couldn't get it out of my head. But how did you develop this sort of, these lengthy pieces? They're meant to take us on a journey, a meditative journey, call it what you will. Let me step back and ask how you arrived at developing this kind of music for yourself, this sort of devotional music.
You know, I've always been interested in, I guess what we call in contemporary culture spirituality, but has been really historically, you know, for all people in the world, if you go back far enough, the spiritual and the profane or the everyday were not separate. So there was this sense of there being a kind of sacred element in all of life. And music and dance, theater were intimately woven into daily life. And then over time, of course, things, we ended up with a lot of splits in human culture, and music got in many ways, in many places, sort of separated off from what we would call, you know, spiritual practice or our experience of the world, because music got corporatized or turned into performance art, really. I've been really interested, especially by encountering more indigenous expressions of music and expressions of music from India, in the reweaving of those things. I grew up, you know, listening to the 3.5-minute pop song, and my albums were always organized in that way. I wrote songs in that way. But I started to see the power of music over time, so long, long extended chants. I traveled to Mexico and been to rituals with Huichol people there who would sing and dance all day and all night long with these extended mantras and songs. And of course, it's very prevalent in Indian music, Pakistani music, in many countries in Africa, these long drumming, chanting sessions. Very, very powerful. And I wanted to work with that kind of a template to make an album. And I started making albums that were an hour long, an hour and 10 minutes long, an hour long. And really saw the power of music that unfolds over time and with an intention to kind of, you know, create states of well-being and ecstasy and peace and joy. I had those experiences by, you know, really being exposed to music in other cultures. And that's where the idea came to create these long-playing albums. And when I do concerts solo, like I'll be doing in Portland, I do a little bit of a mix. So most of the show will be my songs, and then we're going to do an extended version of my piece, Song for All Beings. And there's a local choir coming, and some singers who will be joining me. And that'll play for a little bit of more an extended section, and we'll invite the audience to join us.
It sounds like a Ram Dass concert to me. Krishna Das, I mean, not Ram Dass.
You know, he's very rooted in kirtan, call-response singing. bhakti kind of devotional singing from India that he got influenced by. And I mean, this has a similar kind of, I guess you would call it emotional quality, because there is a sense of everyone joining together.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to being there. And then you come back to lead a sound and healing workshop the following day. What can we expect when we attend that?
It's a day, first of all, that you don't have to have any kind of musical experience to come. Everyone is welcome. And it's we're going to spend the day doing having various musical experiences designed to create states of deep well-being. We will be doing some sounding and chanting, traditional and contemporary kinds of practices that some of them I've just kind of created out of my experience of working with groups. We'll be joining our voices together in harmony. We'll be
You don't have to be a singer.
Not at all.
You just have to bring your voice and yourself.
Yeah, you know, I love Bernice Johnson Reagan. She was the founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock, a musicologist, amazing musician, amazing person. And she says, you know, in the African-American tradition that she's deeply rooted in, that, you know, the songs are the way to get to the singing, you know, and it's all about the singing. It's all about moving vibrations through the body. And so the workshop is not about how we sound. It's about this openness to moving vibrations through the body and see what happens.
Mm.
And it's usually really fun.
It's very
hard to sing and stay in a bad mood at the same time. You have to be very, very devoted to your bad moods.
That sounds good. You have to be devoted to your bad moods, not to enjoy it. That's a mantra for the day. I thank you for that. Maybe it was an accidental offering, but I'll take it. And finally, In These Arms, A Song for All Beings. Set us up for this song. Tell us where the inspiration came, what it's all about.
I was actually out in the hills of California at Spirit Rock Meditation Center doing a retreat there, just days of just sitting in meditation practice in silence. Having that experience that I think many of us have in this time with how to hold the unfolding of the kind of falling apart of the world that seems to be happening now. You know, with all of the things that are so difficult to really open to, climate change and all of the intense racism and violence and so much that's every day in the news. It's just completely overwhelming. And of course, now, of course, the political reality in our country. But this piece just sort of emerged in me, and the song that you're going to play just kind of came through. And then I added this mantra of what in Buddhist practice is called metta, or loving kindness practice. So the chorus, may all beings be happy, may all beings be safe, may all beings everywhere be free. And it's just this invitation to take all of that angst, all of that concern, and really turn it into care and compassion.
Well, Jennifer, it's been a true pleasure getting to know you a little bit in this brief time, and I look forward to seeing you on the 14th.
Thank you so much. I'm so looking forward to coming to Portland.
I cannot turn my eyes. I cannot count the cost of all that has been broken, all that has been lost. I cannot understand the suffering that life brings, war and hate and hunger and a million other things. When I've done all that I can, and I try to do my part, let sorrow be the doorway to an open heart, and the light on the hills is full of mercy.
Learn more about Jennifer's work and music in the world and her upcoming performances, visit kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living, episode 14. Darka Dusty's back with her segment 10 Minutes with Darka, where she tries to save the world in 10 minutes or less with her various guests. This month, Darka's guest is Portland's own Zia McCabe, an American indie rock musician with the band The Dandy Warhols. She's also known as DJ Rescue and now is exploring yet another career pivot, selling real estate. Darka and Zia talk about her thoughts on feminism, her experiences with traveling the world, and her own life here in the Pacific Northwest.
Hi again, this is Darka Dusty with 10 Minutes with Darka. I was off last month, but I'm back, and it's springtime, and my nose is full of blooms, and if I sound sick, I'm not. This is how spring sounds like in my nostrils. But someone who's not going to be bothered by that is my pal Zia McCabe from The Dandy Warhols, and I'm going to spend about 10 minutes talking with Zia about what's going on with her, and maybe we can figure out a way to save the world in 10 minutes, or at least a part of it. How you doing, Zia?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for letting me chat with you this afternoon. It's a beautiful day. But I just, you know, ever since I met you a few years ago when I was in the Volva Underground, I just love watching what you do. I love watching how you tour the world and how you're this incredibly amazing female presence in the Dandies. And I guess my first question is something pretty much what I expect a lot of people would like to know from you. And that is, what is it like being the girl, quote unquote, girl dandy? And, you know, you're in an epic indie rock band. What's it like to be the only girl in that band?
So I've been asked this question before, as you can imagine. And what my stock response became eventually was, I don't know. Why don't you ask Peter? Because to me, he was the more feminine person in the band. And a lot of my roles in the band were, I would say, swing more to the masculine spectrum, making sure we get paid and doing these kind of muscle jobs. So I thought it was a funny way to not have to face the question of what's it like to be the only girl. And I think now, looking back on how I sort of denied feminism for a long time, thinking that they messed it up in the 70s, thinking that, well, spending so much time proving that you can do everything a man can do does just as much to undermine the role of the feminist side, right? If you're just trying, you're then again validating the masculine rather than saying, no, feminine masculine roles have the same worth. So what we need to be doing is having the feminine roles be more respected and valued rather than having everybody swing masculine and everybody work and nobody raising the kids. And I saw a lot of problems with that. And so I just kind of flat out denied feminism until eventually a friend of mine said, you are more feminist than my feminism teacher in college. So I was like, maybe I should relook. And I didn't know about third wave and fourth wave and how much the movement had come along. And so being in the band and being the only girl, I didn't acknowledge boy-girl, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't. And I think that really protected me.
That's interesting.
I had a counselor recently say, you know, the way that you are so much more in touch with your feminine side now that you found this balance that you've been working on, how would it have felt had you gotten to this sooner? And I feel like I would have really struggled.
Yeah, well, it was an evolution, certainly, and that's how we evolve, is by going through these experiences and figuring it out by ourselves.
But I wouldn't have changed it if I was really sensitive to the inequalities and sensitive to the misogyny. I would have been probably pretty miserable. And I think that that's maybe the answer people were expecting back then. They were ready for a real rant.
Right.
You know what's wrong with this is, and I'm not respected for that, And, you know, there were times where I felt like I got a raw deal and Peter would go, it's because you're a girl. I was like, what?
Yeah.
That's why that happened?
Yeah.
Huh. I'm so glad I was unaware of that, because right. that would have really pissed me off. I mean, a raw deal, it pisses you off. But when it's a raw deal because of being a girl, not because something you did that you could fix and improve on later, you're going to be a girl in all the scenarios going forward. Yeah, I'm glad that I kind of found my balance between masculine and feminine after all of my rock and roll 90s.
That's awesome. And so would you say that being a woman has actually benefited you throughout your rock and roll life?
I definitely used my sexuality to my advantage, you know, yeah. and being the only girl in the band, I got to, there's nobody to compete with. I mean, I'm playing synthesizers instead of guitars,
right.
which that already made me niche. Mm-hmm. And, same thing with being a chick. So I got a lot of attention for not really having to do anything special.
That's awesome.
I just gotta be me. And I definitely appreciated those advantages and took advantage of them.
Well, I think it's because of how special you are that it was noticed as well. I mean, it's always obvious when you're in any room. I mean, I've seen it happen. So what about world traveling? You've traveled the world with this band. Have you seen some challenging things that witnessing them and as a woman that you found them to be uncomfortable? Just you've traveled around, like, I don't know, Mediterranean guys tend to be a little more sexist, or I don't know. What did you witness?
I've had some, okay, cultural, I think the stuff. Single most awkward moment was in Israel. We were in this little Muslim community where it's a lot of trading happens. And I can't remember specifically what this group of people are called, but I know that they are allowed to be in the Israeli military.
Right.
So it's a type of Muslim that's more accepted than another type. I'm completely out of my element talking mm-hmm. about this stuff, but we went and we picked out some cool old trinkets and things to bring home. And, I really enjoyed the interaction and the experience there. And I went to shake the shopkeeper's hand.
Right.
No way. No, you don't get to shake my hand. There's no female to male contact. And I was so, well, you know, I was hurt that we didn't get to have this kind of intimate moment after. I thought we were really enjoying each other's company. That's where he drew the line, though. And then I felt, you know, uncultured, like, I'm sorry, I put you in an awkward position. And the whole thing got so weird that boy-girl was so intense.
Okay.
And I thought I just... And knowing that their whole culture, this is a practice.
Yeah.
Not just my weird moment. This is just a thing. And that kind of was thought-provoking, you know. And, you know, of course, there's the boys that chase you in the street in, like, say, Latin countries or Italy. And you say, I'm married. And they're like, where is the husband then? You know, they don't. They're like, so what? I'm still chasing you down. That's just, you know. Doesn't happen in the States as much as it does in the Latin countries, but it's also kind of flattering.
Sure it is. Of course it is. And that's one of the, like, sort of problems, or I guess challenges, as we sort of reconcile what's going on in society right now. For example, the Me Too movement, some people have postured that it stops at rock and roll somehow, that if there was a backlash against the rock and roll, then how would we have rock and roll anymore?
So the politicians got busted, but you can't keep the rockers busted because that sexism is part of what fuels rock and roll?
In a way, yeah. What do
yes,
you think?
Yes, but there are still ways that you can draw the line. And I think, you know, of course there's some unfair backlash in the Me Too with some innocent people going down, because now you get... You know, your whole trial and sentencing happens on Facebook, right?
Right.
And so
exactly.
Innocent people are already guilty before they've even had a chance to retort to the comment. And I lost my train of thought. Where are we in the Me Too moment?
You know, let's just move on from there, because I wanted to talk to you a lot more about political stuff. And okay. I think that you and I should get together for another 10 minutes. Because it takes about mm-hmm. 11 or 12 minutes to save the world.
Yeah.
But we only had 10 today, so okay. I think we should do part two of this right before the midterm elections.
I'd be happy to come back.
But since we have about a minute or so left, tell me what you've been doing in the last year. Because I know you went into real estate, but you also have another very important project that you were starting to talk to me about?
Oh, there's a couple cool gigs. Yeah, A to Z Real Estate has been awesome. I love it. I've been helping artists find their first homes, and you know, it's like I imagined. I really dig it. All the problem solving. The other cool thing is I'm a resident DJ for a few events around town, Pecha Kucha, but Skipping Bedtime is for parents and other tired people. And it's put on by the Baby Blues organization, and they fight postpartum depression. So they've got like a bowling thing called Love Despair, and they have all these little fundraisers around town. And so I DJ on one Sunday every 3 months. It's usually at the White Owl, and I DJ from 6 to 10.
Okay.
So people can come out and get a sitter, but they're not out so late that their next day is ruined.
Nice.
And they can cut a rug and be free from their kids or whatever they need a break from. And I DJ.
Where can they find more information about this?
Either my DJ Rescue page, or if they look up Baby Blues, Skipping Bedtime, if they Google that, they should be able to find it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to talk to you for another, I don't know, let's call it 10 hours. We have so much to unpack and discuss about politics, and we'll save that for November. But for right now, we just wanted to get a little snapshot into your life, and I think we're going to come back and do a part two, and you can like tell us some more stuff about your political ideology, because I know you get really political, and I love that.
It's so funny. I don't see myself as a political person, but you get sucked in, don't you?
Well, we have to do it because we got to save the world.
You look around, you're like, really? Nobody? Okay, fine. I'll do this.
Thanks a lot, Z. I can't wait to talk to you again.
See you and, next time.
Yeah, see you next time. Take care. This has been 10 Minutes with Darka.
Next up, Deborah Giannini returns with some shared thoughts and a performance of one of her favorite songs.
I'm Deborah Giannini, and I perform songs with a sense of place. These are songs that can sometimes work like plane tickets to transport you to someplace in the past or a place you want to go to in the future that you dream about. In this case, today I'm covering a song by a writer that is a little unusual. It is called Rainbow Sleeves. It was written by Tom Waits. And I chose this song because we're entering into a time of celebration of Earth Day, a time of celebration, but also a time of great challenge for us. And it may be a time when we will find it useful to be able to use music in other ways to buoy ourselves, to help each other, to tend and to care for all of us that are working so hard for the changes that we want to see in this world. So I've recorded this song and hope that you can transmit in its message a wonderful Earth Month here in Portland, Oregon, in our Cascadia bioregion, surrounded by the land and the air and the trees that we know are the sustenance of our life and well-being. Keep it open. that's broken is stronger when it's mended. You don't let those blues stop your singing when you've got those broken wings. You can hang on to my rainbow, hang on to my hang on to my rainbow sleeve. It's there for you, babe. You can hang on to my rainbow sleeve.
We have a new contributor this month. Callie Giariti produces a new podcast called Able. It explores real experiences, challenges, and success stories of people in the disability community. In this segment, Callie partnered up with her employer, Renaissance Vocational Services, to wander into the world of employment for blind and visually impaired job seekers.
Everyone, and welcome to Able. My name is Cal, and I am your humble host. My goal for this episode is to give you some insight into what it's like to be a job seeker with a visual impairment, to share knowledge that will help you bring your organization up to speed, and perhaps blow up any expectations you may currently have about what's possible. So let's begin with our first guest.
Yeah, I'm Melissa Robinson. I'm a vocational consultant, and I'm licensed with the state of Oregon as a vocational rehabilitation counselor, and I'm the founder of Renaissance Vocational Services.
I asked her to share what she sees as one of the biggest challenges in visually impaired job seekers getting hired.
One of the biggest challenges I've noticed has been breaking down employers' misconceptions or misunderstandings of what it means to hire somebody with a visual impairment. People with vision loss can do just about anything other employees can do. They just might do it differently and use different tools.
And if you're curious about what types of tools are available.
Sure. My name is Chris Brunenberg. I work as an adaptive technology specialist. There's everything from a screen reader. There's JAWS is the major one that most blind people use. And then there's NVDA, which is a free one. And then there's large print solutions such as Zoom Text, or there's they call it Fusion. So you can run speech and magnification at the same time.
So with visually impaired candidates now being able to compete with their sighted peers, here's Melissa again talking about why employers are becoming even more interested in hiring job seekers with disabilities.
Right now, there's a real push for diversity and inclusion. And I think that fully living those values would include reaching out to people of disabilities, including vision loss. And I also think it's really important that employers have a staff that is representative of the population that they serve.
So let's hear from some of the job seekers themselves.
I'm Kelsey Sparks.
Alan Wilmoth.
My name is Martin Buell.
Eric Patterson.
Sharon Verdine.
My name is Jesus. Now, my name is Jesus, but people do ask if they can call me Jesus, and I'm just like, go for it. I'm looking for customer service type related stuff, or actually sales. I just recently applied to Best Buy. I hope I get it, mainly because of the discounts. But, you know, it'd be great fun, actually, all joking aside.
I'm mainly seeking receptionist work, but I am also thinking about doing sales associate work, also maybe in like customer service.
I'm seeking to start an IT career. Preferably more into the back end, you know, comparing the infrastructure.
I'm pursuing a singing career, which seems to be going pretty well. I have wanted to sing all my life and never considered it an option. And so blindness has given me this Blessing.
I am looking for a good IT support job, or else a research or administrative assistant or something along those lines.
Well, long-term employment, first of all. But specifically, I would like to do some hands-on jobs, like what some people would consider like tedious, like right now I'm doing pizza box folding, but that's, I mean, I love it. It's just too few hours there.
Although these individuals are all connected by some sort of vision loss, their experience of vision varies drastically from person to person. In their own words,
I'm completely blind.
I have never had any usable vision, so everything I do has to include sound or touch.
Retinopathy of prematurity, and then I also have cataracts.
It is mediocre with large expanses of nothingness obscured by a brain that tries to fill in using assumptions.
Technically, it's called Stargardt's. I am looking through a perpetual sparkling, shimmering fog.
I was born with a very rare disease called abnophthalmia, which is very small eyes and no eyes at all. And I got no eyes at all.
As much as the vision of these candidates varies, so do their skills and experience.
Well, I have been through three different colleges.
Contributor to NCTC, North Coast Trail Coalition.
I've had experience in reception work. I've had experience with customer service. I've had experience working in a greenhouse.
Completed a two-year degree at PCC. I've accumulated the Network Plus and the CompTIA A Plus certifications. And I have the Security Plus.
Computer skills, communication skills.
We could fill up an entire podcast alone just talking about the skills, abilities, and extensive training that these job seekers have had. And yet, when we ask them about their experience of job seeking and how long they've been looking for work, here's what they said.
Since my last job, I'd say probably a year.
You know what? I'm not even sure. Probably a few years.
It's been over a year. It might have even been a year and a half.
Well, my last permanent job ended way back in 2003. My current search has lasted since June of 2016, when my last temporary position ended.
The last couple of years, my last job was actually about 9 years ago. I was laid off during the Great Recession.
So we asked Melissa from Renaissance Vocational Services why she thinks it's so hard for these job seekers to get hired.
Going back to when I was a recruiter, I think that, you know, when you're trying to fill a position as a recruiter, you're looking at the candidate pool and you're pulling out the candidates that seem to be the easiest fit. And I think that they see somebody with a disability that might need some job carving or might need some accommodations, and it's less attractive than some of the other candidates that they're getting. So I think that we really need to reach out to the recruiters and have them buy into the idea of inclusion and diversity, and that it's worth it to spend the extra time, because a little investment upfront can have a big payoff when you have a employee that is as loyal and dedicated and skilled as the clients that we represent.
I asked everyone what they wish employers or other sighted individuals would understand, and here's what they said.
There's a couple of things. I think the first thing is that having a fully inclusive and accessible workplace actually benefits everybody. When things are done in an accessible way, a lot of times they're done more quickly, more efficiently, and that can benefit those that aren't vision impaired as well. And then I also wish employers knew that by doing just a little extra work and supported work up front, they can tap into this entire population of job seekers that are eager and loyal, and a lot of them have been using computers most of their life.
I remember when I was going to school in the South, we used to have clients who would teach the assistive technology, and they'd race against maybe a sighted person to find information on the internet, and they would find the information faster 9 out of 10 times. It's crazy.
It's really an unease being around a blind person, just simply because they're not quite sure how to act. And I'm just like your neighbor. I'm the same person I used to be. I just don't see as well.
But the reality is a lot of blind people aren't totally blind. And there are ways to do a lot of the things that anyone else does, but we just can't quite do that last 5 or 10%.
I'm considered what's considered legally blind, but I still have some usable vision. So I guess people should like open their minds up when they think of the term blind, because there's like a very small percentage of people that are totally blind.
You know what? We're normal people. We make mistakes. We fix our mistakes. We learn from our mistakes. And we keep moving forward, even though we have a disability that, you know what? I just want sighted people to know that we're literally as fun-loving and as hardworking as any of you guys out there.
So for employers who do want to make their workplace more accessible, here's Melissa talking about what resources are available.
Yeah, there are a ton of resources. I do think that that might be one of the barriers is employers don't understand that they're not in this on their own. They don't have to figure out accommodations on their own. They don't have to figure out what positions they have that may be accessible on their own, that they can have free support in doing that by partnering with the RenVoke team or partnering with the Oregon Commission for the Blind. And of course, there's also a lot of tax credits that we can help them access.
Time now for the She-Ra Solution with Kristen Thiel. It's a monthly biography of women past and present that was inspired by Maria Theresa Hart's article, She-Ra and the Fight Against the Token Girl, published in The Atlantic. On today's segment, Kristen talks about two women considered invisible by their societies. One was a conductor in Iran, and the other a successful businesswoman right here in the United States.
From the beginning, I've swum against the current. I wasn't seen, the society didn't make any effort to nurture my skills, and the ruling establishment turned its back on me. But I'm still doing it. I'm showing that there are ways, and there will always be. That is what 57-year-old Nezat Amiri of Iran told the Guardian newspaper about living her unique life as an orchestra conductor in a country not always supportive of its women, and certainly not of its women making public declarations and displays. In Iran, it is considered taboo to show musical instruments on state television channels, let alone to show women on stage. For example, women are forbidden from singing solo. And outside the largest urban areas, women are often forbidden from appearing in any musical capacity. The Guardian article on Nezat links to a photo that recently went viral. It shows a female musician who was prevented from joining her male bandmates on stage. She was peeking through the curtains, watching them get to perform. Yet for the past 38 years, Nezat, who has a master's degree in music composition from Tehran Arts University, has been the country's only female conductor. She's also its first. She leads many public performances. And in January 2018, she conducted a 71-member orchestra, made up of musicians and singers, half of them women, at Tehran, Iran's most prestigious concert hall. This performance received a lot of attention in Iran. She earned a front-page photo and interview in one of the daily newspapers. The quote beside that leading photo, "I don't even earn as much as a construction worker." In fact, all 71 members of that orchestra, as well as Nezat, worked for free. This is not just a problem in Iran. Maren Alsup, becoming the first female artistic director of the Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra, made international headlines recently. Last month's She-Ra Solution also referenced this when I talked about the lack of female composers being performed by major orchestras. In a completely different time and space, lived another woman invisible in so many ways to her society, and in just as many ways doing everything she could to be noticed. Sarah Breedlove was born on December 23rd, 1867, in Louisiana. Her parents were recently freed slaves. As their fifth born, Sarah was the first in her family to be born free. However, by the time she turned 7, both her parents had died, and she was sent to live with a sister and her family. This young girl was no longer so free. It is believed that she spent the rest of her childhood picking cotton and cleaning houses in Mississippi. At age 14, she married. A year later, she gave birth to a daughter. 2 years later, she suffered loss again when her husband died. Sarah and her daughter moved to St. Louis, Missouri, where her brothers were barbers. Her daughter went to school, as did Sarah, when she wasn't working as a washerwoman. There she met Charles J. Walker, who would become her second husband. As a young woman, Sarah developed a scalp disorder that caused most of her hair to fall out. Her experiments to create a remedy and treatment for herself caught the attention of Annie Turnbow Malone, a successful entrepreneur in hair care products for African Americans. With Malone's and Sarah's husband's help, Sarah, who is now known as Madam C.J. Walker, much more memorable than Sarah, they all decided, not incorrectly, began advertising and giving demonstrations of her Walker method. This included her own formula for pomade and techniques for brushing hair with heated combs. By 1908, she had a factory and a beauty school. By 1910, her Madam C.J. Walker manufacturing company was worth, in today's money, several million dollars. At her death only 9 years later, in 1919, at age 51, Madam C.J. Walker owned a New York estate and was also the sole owner of her business. It was valued at more than $1 million. Her personal fortune was estimated at between $600,000 and $700,000. Walker was one of the first American women to become a self-made millionaire. Beyond monetary wealth, Madam C.J. Walker stood out in so many other ways. Her Walker agents, the sales beauticians, strive to enhance their clients' outward appearance, not just for superficial reasons. In a racist society, African Americans and other minorities have to go above and beyond to have a chance of being seen in the best light. So Walker saw her philosophy of cleanliness and loveliness as helping African Americans advancing in society. Walker worked beyond the philosophical to the practical, organizing philanthropic and educational efforts among African Americans. She donated the largest amount of money by an African American toward the construction of an Indianapolis YMCA in 1913. She also funded the opening of the Walker Building, an art center in Indianapolis, which opened after her death. It is now a registered National Historic Landmark. Her daughter lived her mother's dream well. She became a well-known part of the Harlem Renaissance. And in 1998, the United States Postal Service issued a stamp of Madam C.J. Walker. Both Nezahat Amiri and Madam C.J. Walker swam against the current, unseen by society, until society couldn't help but notice them. I'm your host, Kristen Thiel, and I'll be back next month.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Politics of Living. Thanks to our guests for appearing on today's program and our contributors, Kristen Thiel, Darka Dusty, Deborah Giannini, Kali Giaridi, and Anessa Anderson. Also, thanks to our technical editor, VM Delta, and our webpage manager, Vicky Mazzone. Be sure to visit kboo.fm and search for The Politics of Living, Episode 14, to find links about today's topics and guests. We're going to close out the show today with a song by Portland band, Tango Alpha Tango. Thanks so much for listening to The Politics of Living. I'm Denise Kowalczyk. Have a great day.
take some rocks and gravel, baby. Lead you right to your